Interview with Donald Calvin, June 13th, 2007, in New York City, by Kenneth Durr.
We talked on the phone really briefly about your background in Illinois as Commissioner of Securities in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Right.
And did you go to school there as well?
Yes, yes.
Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to Eastern Illinois University undergrad. And that in those days it was a teacher's college, and therefore you had to have practice teaching to graduate, which I didn't do. And then I went on to the University of Illinois College of Law, and at that time they had a four-year law school program where you could enter in your senior year in college, because I didn't have an undergraduate degree because of the practice teaching.
Right.
And so they took, I started in the middle of the year in February. There were 26 of us that started, and we took contracts too, and TARTS too, rights and land too, because they had made no accommodation.
There was no
so it was terrible. The first period, and then I went to summer school, and then come that fall, I took contracts one, and so it really got easier as you went on.
You must have been real good at it by then.
Well, it was tough. I was married and we had a little daughter, and I worked. I worked full time in different jobs, and we couldn't afford to rent an apartment. The wife and I, we'd been in Charleston, Illinois, which is where Eastern Illinois is located, and Champaign-Urbana is about 50 miles to the north. And when we went to, and the law school was right on this road as you came from the south, from Charleston, this back road. The first road you really hit in Urbana led you right into the university and right to the law school. Very convenient. And down that road was a new real estate development being put up by National Homes, which are prefabricated homes. And I had a friend at Eastern whose family lived in Urbana, and he said they had an apartment that they would rent to us for $95 a month. So the wife and I went to see it, and it was a basement, in their basement. Mm. And on the way out, going back to Charleston, we stopped at the display home at this National Homes. And the fella there was a graduate of Eastern Illinois University. And I told him that we looked at this apartment for $95 a month, and he said, for $59 a month, I can put you in this house we're building right down the street on Florida Avenue. And they were just putting this thing up. It took them 2 days to put it up. And we looked at it, and it was $59 a month, including insurance and everything. So we bought it. It was $300 out. And so we lived in that house, and right down the street, you went down the same, down Florida Avenue, past the president's home, past, to the law school. So it was very convenient.
Did you specialize in corporate law when you were in
No, the law school there at that time was heavy in real estate law and estates because of the agricultural nature of the state at the time. But there was a professor that taught corporate and securities law by the name of George Frampton. And he was from New York City, and he had been a partner in one of the major New York City law firms. And he was terrific, and that's what got my interest in corporate law, was okay. Professor Frampton.
So by the time you got out of law school, you were thinking in those terms?
No, not at all. When I was in law school, I read this book. Again, I worked full-time. I worked initially as a meat cutter in a market in Rantoul, Illinois, which was to the north, about 20 miles. So I would have to drive to Rantoul in the afternoons and work in the market till the close, and I worked there all day Saturday and Sunday. And that was difficult. And then I got to know this fellow that was in the insurance business, a local agent, and I worked with him and sold hospitalization insurance for a while for White Cross, which is opposed to Blue Cross. And then that you worked on a commission that was very difficult. And then I met somebody else that were insurance inspectors, insurance investigators. They didn't want you to call them insurance investigators because that upset people. And it was people that applied for life insurance or people applied for auto insurance, and you'd do an inspection, and you'd get paid a dollar or a couple dollars for each inspection, so I did that. And in the process, I read a book in law school about the country lawyer. And it was about some small-town lawyer, like in Illinois or somewhere, and what a great life it was, and he helped all these people out. And I was impressed with that, and I thought, this is terrific. You know, it's like the small-town doctor. And so when it came time to look for a job in the law school, they had one professor who in his spare time ran a placement service. And I told him that, and he said, I got the ideal job for you in Farmer City, Illinois. And Farmer City was about, I'd say, 30 or 40 miles east of or west of Champaign-Urbana, so it was very convenient. It was a country lawyer, really. So I went to work for that law firm. It was Herrick and Rudisill. And the Herrick of the firm was an elderly man whose brother had been justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, Lot Herrick, I remember his name. And their father, after the Civil War, when he was discharged, set up this law office in Farmer City, Illinois, but had no formal legal education, and he had studied law in somebody's law office. And the office was basically untouched since the 1860s. To make copies, they had a letterpress. I don't know, have you gone to law school? The letterpress was, the old cases, they talked about a letterpress copy, and they would, and that's what they had in the office. And they had this woman, Nora Tobin, who was the secretary, and she ran the office, and she had a cane, and she must have been in her 80s or something. Her mother was over 100 years old, and she cared for her mother. And whenever you wanted to do anything, you had to say, "Miss Tobin, would you please come in?" It was like that Carol Burnett comedy show, and she would come in with her cane, and she would then sit down with her stenographic book. And then you'd say, "Well, I'm going to dictate this letter." And you'd think a minute. She would then put down her pencil and her book. And you'd say, "Okay, dear so-and-so," and she'd pick just a minute. She'd pick up. It was impossible. Well, after a few months, I realized this was not for me. So I went back to the Professor Bowman at the law school and said, "Do you have any other jobs?" I'd moved the family. We were in this big house in Farmer City and so forth. And I was in this office by myself because the principal office was in Clinton, the county seat. And he said, "Well, I just got a call from the Secretary of State's office in Springfield, and they're looking for somebody in their securities division." And as luck would have it, I had, among other things, Nora Tobin, the secretary, was the correspondent for the Bloomington Pantograph newspaper, which is the local daily newspaper. And they had wanted to do an article about something having to do with the law, and about, for some reason, they picked securities law. So I had, and Nora said, "Would you do this interview with this reporter?" And I said, "Sure." And it's on the Illinois securities law and so forth. And so I read the Illinois securities law to get prepared for this article. And it was the Illinois securities law, 1953. And it turned out it was really a good law. And I said so and so forth. Well, when I had this interview, I went to Springfield, and I met the Assistant Secretary of State, Samuel H. Young III, who was a terrific guy, and he's still terrific. And he had seen the article. But what he wanted, he didn't want somebody in the securities division. The legislature was in session, and he wanted somebody to assist him in following legislation in the state legislature. Sam was a nervous twit. He was a fellow that had a tick. You know, he'd always put his hand under his collar like his collar was too tight, even when he didn't have a shirt on, right? And he was in and out of this office in the state capitol. I sat there all day, and I saw him maybe a total of 10 minutes. And during that time, he would say, "Here's some paper. Write out your background and what you would like to do." So I wrote this thing out. And at the end of the day, he said to me, "I got to go to this meeting." He said, "I'll leave your phone number. I may or may not call you." So I drove back to Farmer City, and when I got home, there was a phone call waiting from Sam Young that evening, which I returned. He said, "I want you to start work tomorrow in our securities division." And I said, doing what? He said, being an attorney in the securities division. I said, well, I can't do it tomorrow, but I gave him 2 weeks' notice, so I gave 2 weeks' notice and I started. This would have been in the spring of 1957.
So what kind of work did you do as an attorney?
Well, again, the law was the Illinois Securities Law of 1953, which had been written by Sam Young. And what it was, Sam Young had worked for the SEC for a while, I think in their regional office in Chicago. And this was a fair, just, and equitable law. The Illinois had had a blue sky law, as they called it, a securities law, since 1918. And what happened in that period is that these laws were directed against the bucket shops and boiler rooms in New York City to protect the local populace, and they were fair, just, and equitable laws. In other words, it wasn't just disclosure as under the 33 Act, and also had a comprehensive scheme of registration for broker-dealers, investment advisors, and so forth and so on. Well, when Sam Young and his associates rewrote the law in 1953, they wrote it as a fair, and just, and equitable law, and disclosure wasn't adequate. So each offering was reviewed, each registration, securities registration, was reviewed carefully as to whether, if there were options to promoters, that was not permitted, unless they paid the same price as the public paid. There were all type of standards like that. They would require appraisals of property. I examined, along with, there were two or three other attorneys in the office, we examined these filings, and if we felt that they were not equitable or the disclosures were not adequate or whatever, we would refuse to register it in the state. It was totally different than the SEC's approach.
Yeah, and that must have been pretty good experience, because you're really scrutinizing.
That's right. Well, I remember when Freedomland in New York City, I'd never been to New York City at that point in time, this is 1957, and some promoters here had developed Freedomland, which is up where Co-op City is now in New York City. And Freedomland was to be like Disneyland. And one of the things which we required, and they had contributed the property, and for that they got cheap stock, which was a no-no under our regulations. And if you did that, we required an independent appraisal of the property to determine if it was valued at the same price as the stock being sold to the public, which, of course, it wasn't, right? So we refused to register Freedomland.
So how long did you do that?
Well, I did that. That was 57. And then in 59, May 5th, 1959, I was, the wife and I, when we first moved to Springfield, we rented this apartment. We had the one daughter, Jane. We rented this apartment in a duplex complex called Gordon Court. We wanted to build a new house. So there was this new development on the outskirts of Springfield. And we went to the local lumber company, which was doing the development. And they arranged financing as well as finding a contractor. So we found this contractor who had been, that they recommended, who was a local, had a retired high school teacher in Springfield. And he said that he would build this house for $17,000 if I did some of the work. And one of the work that I had to do was to dig the water line from the street to the foundation. Well, anyhow, on May 5th was the day that I had to do that. And I went home early from the office, was digging the water line, and a neighbor came running over and said, there's an all-call from the Secretary of State's office on our phone. They're looking for you. So I went next door to the neighbor. And they said it was the then Assistant Secretary of State, Bob Cronson, who succeeded Sam Young. And Bob said, we want you to have dinner with the Secretary of State tonight, who was my big boss. And I didn't tell him I already had dinner and I was digging this ditch, right? So I said, okay. So I went to dinner and read dinner. And the Secretary of State was a very, he wanted to be around people. He did not like being alone. It was sort of a quirk of his. And he always had to have somebody with him. And his name was Charles F. Carpentier. And he was an elected, statewide elected official. He was the top vote getter in the state at the time. And we go through this dinner, and they're telling all these political stories and stuff, and I wonder, what in the world am I doing here, you know? And at the end of the dinner, we're walking out of the restaurant, and Bob Cronson turned to the Secretary of State and said, isn't there something you want to tell Don? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, this securities division, you're it. You're the head of it. He said to Bob Cronson, anything else? He said, well, yeah, do you want to tell him anything? He said, oh, yeah, don't do anything that'll embarrass me. And then they said to Cronson, okay, let's go. And I turned around and Cronson shook my hand. And I was the Illinois Securities Commissioner. I was 26 years old.
So what did that involve?
Well, it was the under the what Sam Young had done in writing the Illinois Securities Act in 1953, he had put in there that the head of the securities division was of the Secretary of State's office would have the title Illinois Securities Commissioner. That was very significant in those days because the politicians didn't want anybody to have a title. Every letter we sent out of that office, we signed the name Charles F. Carpentier. We never signed our own name. Everybody practiced signing it. I can still sign his name in his distinctive way. And so there was only one commissioner, right? It's not like the SEC. And we made the decisions on all these offerings coming in. Any broker dealer that was doing business in the state had to be licensed, all investment advisors. And then the other thing we had under the Illinois law is that the law had a provision where a person could buy anything they wanted, but you couldn't sell any securities unless it was either registered or exempt from registration or sold in an exempt transaction. And what we would do is we would scour the newspapers and whatever and find out people that had, and complainants would come in, that had bought securities that were not registered, were not exempt, or were not in an exempt transaction. One of the exempt transactions was that you could sell to 15 persons or less if you filed a report with the Secretary of State's office, with our office within 30 days and disclosed all the details. And, of course, many people didn't do that. So when we would find them, we would have them come in or we would have investigators go out, and we would then have them make an offer of rescission. They would send out a form letter that we'd prepared that offered to buy the securities back at that price plus the legal rate of interest, and that offer would be outstanding for 30 days. And we did millions of dollars of this would happen every year. It was terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A real change from the way the SEC...
That's right. Exactly.
So you got some administrative experience.
Well, at that time also, this is back to the SEC. That's when I first had contact with the SEC. And one of the people that I had the first contact with was Irv Pollack. You know, Irv, at that time, was really the head of enforcement for the SEC. And, of course, we were vigorous enforcers. I mean, we got a lot of publicity because of the Chicago papers and the Springfield papers. We would we'd arrest people in the office, the prosecuting attorney, the state's attorney in Sangamon County was a good friend of mine, and I would sign a complaint for these people's arrest, and they would take them down to the jail and lock them up in this old jail in Sangamon County where Abraham Lincoln probably had people locked up. Sometimes we would have the state police catch them out on the road. They're trying to leave the state. It was all type of thing. And we would give these stories to the press, and we got a lot of good publicity and did a good job, really.
So why did your Pollack contact?
Well, because we were very active, and we were just because an SEC would register an offering of securities didn't automatically mean we would. And so there was a lot of people were upset in the securities bar in New York and in Chicago. Because they would make these routine, what they thought was routine filings. And under this law, there was nothing routine. I mean, you had to meet these standards, and all of the things that promoters love to do, we would always turn that down, like the cheap stock or options to promoters or whatever, and like the real estate appraisals and all of that type of thing. So it attracted a lot of interest.
You would catch things that would slip through.
Nothing slipped through. We went. Nothing slipped through. And because of that, what happened too with the SEC is that there were a number of states that were like this at that time, one of which was Wisconsin and California. California at that time, the the commissioner then was a man by the name of John Sobieski. He was appointed by the first governor, Brown. And Sobieski admired what we did, and so did some of the people in the commissioner in Iowa, for example, started to do the same thing. So Bob Cronson and I organized what we call the Midwest Securities Commissioners Association, which were the fair and just and equitable regulators. And even though it was Midwest, it included California, Arizona, Kansas, which is still Midwest, I guess. And there were probably half a dozen or 10 states that formed this association. And we would cooperate on enforcement matters and also on in the registration of securities process if we thought there were options or whatever that shouldn't allow it to be sold in the state. They would do the same. So it became a formidable thing.
How much would you work with the regional office of the
SEC? The regional office at that time was headed by a man by the name of Tom Hart in Chicago, and Tom Hart was terrific. I think he probably had been the regional head of that regional office since the SEC started in 1934, and we cooperated with them all the time. But again, they were doing different things than we were doing. We were looking for people who were local, who were doing things, selling securities in Illinois that were not registered or fraud type things, and they were not doing that type of thing. They were doing on a bigger overall type of picture, and our authority was much broader than their authority.
How'd you get to FI DuPont?
Well, what happened is that I was 26 years old when this first started, when I became the commissioner. And we were very busy because in that period, if you check back in history, in the 1957-58 period was a very active period for IPOs. It was very busy, and our workload increased tremendously. And at the same time, the Secretary of State was up for re-election. Remember, this is a political office. And matter of fact, I might mention that I was a political appointee that day that Sam Young hired me. And he said, you know, this is a Republican office. Are you a Republican? I said, no, I'm a Democrat. And he said, well, he said, okay. He said, you have to be sponsored by a Republican. I'll get some state senator, you know, that's a friend of mine to sponsor you. So I became an instant Republican as a result. But anyhow, the Secretary of State was a dedicated man, I thought, at the time. And he was up for re-election, so I worked in the re-election campaign and so forth. And then come in early 1962, we had one of our Midwest Securities Commissioners meetings, which we had in the winter in January in Scottsdale, Arizona, which is a good place to ever meet. and at that meeting, and I'd met again, who I'd met before, Alger B. Chapman, who was the vice president of the New York Stock Exchange for Government Relations. Duke Chapman is his nickname. And I met Duke before that, and he would come to these meetings in his liaison capacity with the state regulators from the New York Stock Exchange. And at this meeting in Scottsdale, in that period, and he told me he was looking for somebody to be his assistant at the New York Stock Exchange in government relations. And I said, well, you know, I might be interested in that. No, you're talking about, I skipped a period, the DuPont. Oh, FI DuPont. What happened after the Secretary of State's election, I got this offer for a job with A.C. Allen and Company in Chicago, A-L-L-Y-N. A.C. Allen and Company was the largest NYSE member firm in the Midwest. They were headquartered in Chicago. The Allen brothers were quite well-known business people, entrepreneurs. Among other things, they owned the Chicago White Sox, and their father had started this firm, who was still alive when I came there. And I went to work with a partner of the firm by the name of Jim Snyder as the syndicate manager in doing underwritings, IPOs. We would put together Jim was the partner, and I was his. He had another fellow who was his assistant, who was much more knowledgeable than I, but I also worked with him on getting these things registered in the various states and getting the underwriting group together. And that was very interesting. And then the market broke in 1962, May 1962. And after that market break, the older Allen brother, Arthur Allen, made a deal over a weekend with Francis I. DuPont and Company, which is here at One Wall Street, to buy the firm. And this was a shock. There were 26 partners, and he then, after he made this deal, he called them together, and they had what they called a last supper and notified that they no longer were partners. He'd sold the firm. And the younger brother, John, was reluctantly went along with it. But anyhow, so it now was a firm headquartered out of One Wall Street, New York, not on LaSalle Street.
So did you pick up and move?
Well, what happened is that they invited me to come to New York. I came to New York, and I met the fellow that was in charge of the investment banking area, and he said, well, you'll hear from me. And I went back, and there was a fellow who now headed the office in Chicago by the name of Tommy Thompson. He had been an ex-pro football player, a very nice guy. And he was Francis I. DuPont and Company, now the firm was. And I talked to Tommy, and he said, you know, that's the same thing he said to me, and I heard from him 3 years later. But yeah, now I'm back to where I was before. So about that time, I went to this meeting in Scottsdale, and I met Duke Chapman, and Duke said they were looking for somebody and so forth, and I said I might be interested. I'm back to that now. This is 1964. And anyhow, so I left Duke on a Sunday, and that night and I went back to Chicago in Wilmette, Illinois, where I lived. And I got a call from Duke, and he said that the president of the exchange, Keith Funson, wants to meet you tomorrow. And I said, tomorrow? He said, yes, tomorrow. Can you come to New York? And I said, I guess so. So I went to New York. And I walk into Keith Funston's office with Duke. Keith Funston was a terrific, legendary figure. He was a very tall, handsome Swedish man that headed up. He was president and CEO of the New York Stock Exchange. And he's the one that started this program, Own Your Share of America, which is another whole interesting story. And he was a very aggressive, very personable type of fellow. So I go into Keith Funston's office, whom I'd never met before, and it turned out that Keith Funston was from somewhere in South Dakota, from the Midwest. And I was from this little town in Illinois, Mount Olive, Illinois. And he asked me the questions like you and I are talking about. And he then says, okay, you're hired, and the salary will be so-and-so. And I said, I can't move my family to New York for that salary. And he said, what do you mean? This is a great opportunity. He got angry. And Duke Chapman said, just a minute, come here. And I said, we'll work it out, just say yes to him. So I said, yeah. So I said to Duke, I cannot move my family for whatever the amount of money was. And he said, don't worry, I'll work it out. He said, what we'll do is, after 3 months, I'll get you a raise to another $1,000, whatever it is, and we'll pay all your living expenses, we'll pay all your moving expenses, and so forth. And we'll work it out. And he did work it out, and I did move, and so forth. Stayed there 24 years, 25 years.
Now, did Keith Funston remember that you'd said no to him on your first meeting?
He never forgot anything. He was terrific. And Duke was terrific, and Duke still is a terrific friend, and I'm in contact with him all the time. He's a great person, a great friend. Duke then left after 2 years, and I succeeded him. Keith immediately made me vice president of the exchange, of which there were only eight at that time. There were very few, most of whom had been there 50 years or more. Duke and I were the young boys on the block. Yes, he remembered everything, and he had this policy that you had to be there when he was there, and he would take the month of August off for vacation, and you had to be there when he was on vacation. And then every year I got 2 weeks vacation, and he would come in and complain, "You haven't taken your 2 weeks vacation." I said, "Keith, you told me, right, that I had to be here when you're not here, and I had to be here when you are here." So when I actually left, the New York Stock Exchange paid me a year's vacation. I think even like a year's vacation. I never take a vacation.
Well, Keith Funston had some run-ins with the SEC by this point.
Well, yes. When I first started, they had all kind of problems with the SEC. I might mention that during this period when I was in Springfield, one of the lawyers that I dealt with was Milton Cohen. Milton Cohen was the lawyer that created the Chicago Board Options Exchange. And Milton, and I was the Illinois Securities Commissioner at the time, and Milton came to see me, and they outlined this scheme, and I said, "Milton, I don't think you can do this under Illinois law." And I went to the law library and found this old case that had ruled that put and call options were gambling contracts under the Illinois Criminal Code, which had not been changed. The Criminal Code provided that if you made a delivery in cash, that was a gambling contract. And that's what they were going to do. And so what we worked out is we changed the law to allow the CBOE to be created, thanks to the efforts of Milton and myself and some other people. So I knew Milton. So when Milton became the head of the SEC special study, which again was created by a congressman from that district in Illinois, Peter Mack. He was from Carlinville, Illinois, which is, and he was the congressman for the district. Anyhow, when they created this special study of the securities market because of the market break in 1962, in May of 1962, that's what led to it. And Milton called me and said he had taken this job, and would I go to Washington with him to be his associate? And I said, "I don't think so. I mean, I don't want to. You know, I enjoyed the working with people at the SEC. They were terrific people. I had a good relationship with the staff and the commissioners, but I didn't think I wanted to do that. And I went to the New York Stock Exchange instead."
So did you get Keith Funston's take on the special study?
Well, yes. What happened, by the time I arrived, Milton was finishing up the special study, and a lot of it had to do with specialists, regulation of specialists. And the first week on the job, by that time, Bill Carey was chairman of the SEC. Mm-hmm. And I'd known Bill Carey, and again, from my dealings as the Illinois Securities Commissioner in these various meetings we went to. And I went down to see Bill Carey, and he was not very happy about it. Well, floor traders was the first thing that they did, floor trading. And they were trying to put the floor traders out of business and so forth.
What was the stock exchange's position?
Well, the stock exchange's position, which did prevail, was that they did contribute to the liquidity of the market. And therefore, if the regulation made them have, I can't remember what we called it anymore, but they had to meet certain standards whereby their transactions were beneficial to the market, and there was a whole term for that which I don't remember anymore, and a whole formula of all their trading was surveilled, and that trading had to contribute to the efficiency of the market. Most of them went out of business, but a few did continue on after that. In the case of the specialists, there was a whole body of regulation of the specialists developed, too, at that time, as out of the special study. And by the time that came along, Bill Carey had gone, and Manny Cohen was chairman. And I'd known Manny from his days on the SEC staff and had a good relationship with him. And Duke Chapman and I, primarily Duke, worked out that specialist regulation with Manny. And after it worked out, the SEC staff thought, you know, this is going to put these people, for the most part, out of business like it did the floor traders, but it didn't, because they did contribute to the liquidity of the market and so forth. Yes, uh-huh. And it was a reasonable compromise that still exists to this day. It really has not been changed any significant way over these past, what have been now, 40 years now.
Now, didn't the stock exchange do its own study on floor traders?
Well, that was a part of it, yeah. The exchange did studies on floor traders. I think they did a study on specialists and so forth, too. And that's what came out of this. I mean, it was a process of negotiation over a period of years. But the government relations staff at that time was Duke Chapman and myself, or just the two of us. We didn't have any, there was no Washington office or anything. And about that time, when I came in there, there was the Association of Stock Exchange Firms, ASEF, which is the predecessor to SIFMA today, Securities Industry Financial, Financial Markets Association, formerly the SIA. So it was ASEF, SIA, and SIFMA. In those days, it was ASEF.
SIA was a lot easier.
Yeah. ASEF was a lot easier. And ASEF was a organization of the top CEOs of the top firms around the country, not just New York, but regionally, and of which there were many. And I would go to those meetings as the New York Stock Exchange representative. One of their major members in activity was a firm in Chicago called Cruttenden Podesta, headed by a fellow by the name of Bob Podesta, who was a terrific personality, very outgoing type of personality, you know, the type of fellow that played the piano and sang it and went out and, you know, always told stories and everybody loved him and so forth. And Podesta, one of the things that he, when I was in Springfield, he was one of the people that tried to keep me in line and working with the Chicago firms. And he did the same thing in Washington with the SEC. And there was a fellow that worked for him as a PR person by the name of Sam Lyons. And Sam Lyons, in his earlier days, had been a reporter for some newspapers in Washington. And on the time of the special study, Sam Lyons went to Washington full-time covering the special study activities and all the hearings they had in that. And an arrangement was worked out between Bob Podesta and Duke Chapman to New York Stock Exchange would pay half his salary and the ASEF would pay half his salary. So he had a small two himself and a secretary office on Capitol Hill next near the Supreme Court building, in a building that no longer exists. And he was the New York Stock Exchange office in Washington along with the ASEF office. And he was not a lawyer, and Sam was a reporter. And he would go to the SEC every day, knew everybody at the SEC staff, knew the commissioners, and he would report to us daily by writing a memo, which he mailed, on what was happening at the SEC.
One of the things I want to unpack a little bit is the idea of the floor traders and the specialists. Now, one of the issues that the SEC had was them not fulfilling any public sort of good function, the idea that they weren't, you know, contributing to the market. It also had something to do with governance of the New York Stock Exchange.
That's right. That's right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, let's talk about the governance issue came to a head later on. When I first came there, there was a 34-person board, 33 or 34. I'm certain whether it's 33 or 34.
It was 34.
34. Okay. Of those 34, three were called public. They were called Board of Governors. They met every week, every Thursday. Three of the governors were public governors. They were elected by the other 30, and the 31 being the president of the exchange, Keith Funston, in those days. So Keith would nominate these people to be public directors, and the rest of the board would elect them. The others were elected by the membership. Some of them had been on the board for more than 20 years. The board met, as I said, every Thursday. I had to give a report every Thursday on government relations. And the way the board room was configured, it was like a legislative chamber with tiers. There were three or four tiers. Then there was a well, the lowest point in the room. And then there was a dais type thing, which is still over there. And it was from the old call market. And it was, behind that dais there was a chair and a footstool, and the chairman sat behind on that chair with his feet on that footstool, and he was at the highest point in the room. the staff that reported to the board, or whoever reported to the board in the well, was at the lowest point in the room. And then there were the tiers, and they sat in college-type chairs with that little arm thing where you could write on, right? And all their papers would be stacked up there, and they had to approve every listing. They had to approve. They had to approve every new member coming in. They had to act on every disciplinary process, and the older, the more senior members sat in the last row rather than the first row, because they were up now high and they could see what was going on. The members in the first row to hear, and there were no microphones. Nobody had a microphone, and the people in the first row were like the public governors were in the first row, and they would have to turn around to see who was talking and try and hear what they had to say from up there. So that's the setting. So they'd give a report every week to that board.
How much back and forth was there in these meetings, or was it bunches?
Well, what had happened in the 1940s, there was a revolution took place, and it was led by a floor broker by the name of William McChesney Martin. He was a floor broker for us. He was from St. Louis, and he was a floor broker for a St. Louis firm. And he led a revolution because the exchange was being run by committees, and the committee chairmen were all powerful. And there was a committee for this and a committee for that. And he became the first, Bill Martin in 1940, became the first full-time president of the New York and CEO of the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
And then the war started out, and he enlisted in the military as a private and worked his way up as an officer and ultimately became chairman of the Fed. But he revised the place so that you had a full-time professional staff, and the committees were less important. They were still important and less important. But what happened over those years, there's intervening years, from the 40s to when I got there in the 60s, is you had this 34-person board that met every week, but the public governors only invited in once a month. It was the third Thursday of every month. And so they didn't know what was going on. Most of them said very little for the whole time they were there, except that they were at their retirement dinner. And there were some very distinguished people. When I got there, Milton Eisenhower was on the board. He was the brother of the president and the head of John Hopkins, Jack Straus, who was the chairman of the board of Macy's, people like that, terrific people. But they had very little input because this, whatever happened at the board meeting happened during the month, and that one board, that policy board meeting was anticlimactic. There was also a committee, of which I can't remember the name of, that met before the board meeting, and they decided everything, you know, at that meeting. So the board meetings are anticlimactic, for the most part.
And so the idea then is that the floor traders and the specialists are electing these 30...
The floor traders and the specialists controlled the board as well as the institution. They were clearly in control. And in some ways that was good because they had... Their primary interest was maintaining that institution as a viable institution. And they devoted their lives to it, as well as that's where they got their livelihood. The chairman of the board rotated every 2 years. And up until the time when Gus Levy, who was then the head of Goldman Sachs, was elected chairman, all of the chairmen had come from the floor, from the trading floor. And he served a 2-year term. He was not paid. He didn't receive a salary. But what he did receive is the chairman always managed to get the good new listings, which was important for his business. So in terms of corporate governance then, what happened after there was Keith Funston left, Bob Hack became the president of the exchange. Bob Hack was from Milwaukee. I'd known him when I was in Chicago with H.C. Allen & Company. He was with Robert W. Baird & Company and became the chairman of the NASD, which was a part-time, non-executive position. And Bob Hack was selected as president of the exchange and succeeded Keith Funston. About the time that Hack came in, the paperwork crisis developed. The paperwork crisis developed because at that time firms were, and the New York Stock Exchange was switching to computers. When I came there, They didn't have one computer, zero computers. I don't know if you're interested.
Paperwork rights is set in about 68 or so.
What's that?
Paperwork rights is set in about
67, 68, 69. And that led to the exchange was able to handle the volume, but the member firms who were converting to computers were not able to handle the sustained volume, which was like 1 million shares a day. I mean, by today's standards, it was nothing. But anyhow, so what happened, the exchange shut down on Wednesdays so that the firms could try and catch up on transactions. Several firms lost control of their records and went bankrupt. Most notably, it was Goodbody and Company. And the partners, it was a partnership and declared bankruptcy. Also, I might mention at that time, you know, when I came there, the firms had to be partnerships. Corporate firms were not allowed. And every partner had to be approved by the board of the exchange. Quotes, for example, at that time could only be given to a member firm of an exchange. They were not available to the public at that time. I was involved in changing that, which is another story. But the paperwork crisis came about because of computerization, the switching to computers, and no different than it is today. You know, the computer people tell you everything is great, and
right. You
turn the switch and the thing blows up. This happened at AC Allen when I was there, for example.
It wasn't because the market was going so big that they just couldn't keep up.
Well, what happened, it was a combination. It was a perfect storm type thing, is that they were switching to computers, and at the time they were switching, the volume suddenly surged. Again, by today's standards, it was low.
Right.
So it was the combination of two, and these firms were partnerships, and they had very little expertise with respect to technology, which is, you know, true throughout all of industry. It was not unique to these firms. And so the technology people were not partners for the most part in those days. And the thing just, you know, they could not handle, the firms could not handle the volume of business, and they lost control of their records, and financially they were destroyed.
What could the exchange do to help the member firms?
Not very much. And what the exchange did is they shut down on Wednesdays so that they'd have time to try and catch up on their record keeping. Well, anyhow, out of this came the SEC hearings and led to legislation, H.R. 5050, which was the Securities Act amendments in 1975, ultimately came out of this. But also what came out of it was a look-see at the governance of the exchange. Also, the creation of what became DTC came out of that, because one of the other problems was that since these firms were partnerships and corporate firms and institutions were not allowed to become members, the bank transactions, banks were outside the clearing system, which was then owned by the New York Stock Exchange. Each exchange in the country had its own clearing system. There was no such thing as a depository. One of the first things I worked on when I came there with Duke Chapman was to change the laws of all 50 states to allow the transfer of securities by bookkeeping entry, which was not allowed by the Uniform Commercial Code at that time.
So you were still issuing certificates at that?
You had to issue certificates. The Uniform Commercial Code required certificates. And I went around the country and got the laws changed in 2 years in 50 states by amending the Uniform Commercial Code in those states to allow transfer of securities by bookkeeping entry, which is another series of interesting stories, like in Louisiana. We went to Louisiana and did that. They had a special session of the legislature in Louisiana to do it. There were two listed companies in Louisiana, and once they found out that they were going to be outside the system, they got it done. But anyhow, so the New York Stock Exchange has been working on what they call the CCS, which was the predecessor to DTC. After the paperwork crisis, there was this committee was created, the Banking and Securities Industry Committee, headed by a fellow by the name of Herman Beavis, who was a banker. And they looked at what could have been done, what should be done to avoid this again in the future. And a number of things out of that came DTC, which is a New York trust company. And initially was New York Stock Exchange contributed all of the work it had done in creating the CCS system, and therefore it was initially the majority shareholder of DTC, and there was a whole complicated provision whereby each year the banks would buy these shares that were held by the New York Stock Exchange at some nominal value, so that. And I was the New York Stock Exchange representative on the DTC board during those years.
Do you remember what the acronym stands for, DTC?
Depository Trust Company. And it was headed by Bill Dentzer. Bill Dentzer had been the New York State Banking Superintendent. Again, the banks wanted to have a say in this, and they were well represented on the board. All the top New York bank institutions are represented on the board, usually by their chairman. But anyhow, that whole scenario led to hearings by John Moss, Congressman Moss, and the House Security Subcommittee, and by Senator from New Jersey, Harrison Williams, and Steve Paradise. On the Senate side, Al Harris on the Senate staff. Charlie Curtis on the House side staff that worked for John Moss. Consuelo Washington, who's still there, by the way, worked on this at the time. And they had this comprehensive legislation being considered in the House. As luck would have it, Sam Young, the fellow that hired me, was a congressman from Illinois on the House Security Subcommittee.
How about that?
Wasn't that great? That's right. And this legislature that was, and the lawyer for the John Moss's subcommittee was Bill Painter, William Painter, who was a professor at the University of Illinois College of Law. He had not been there when I was there, unfortunately, for me. And the legislation as originally proposed would have done away with the New York Stock Exchange. It would have. Any broker dealer could automatically become a member of an exchange. So they did away with the original legislation would have done away with the concept of membership. At that time, the New York Stock Exchange was an unincorporated association, which it had been through its period of history when it first organized. One of the things we did after the paperwork crisis, when these firms were failing, was incorporate the New York Stock Exchange as a not-for-profit corporation in New York, which is another interesting story as to how that happened. But anyhow, the legislation and John Moss and Bill Painter and the staffs there, that original legislation would have done away with the New York Stock Exchange. So it was a tough period of time. And out of it came H.R. 5050, which ultimately the New York Stock Exchange supported. A lot of the members opposed it, but it was a good compromise. Still exists today. The national market system, all of those standards that are still in there were developed at that time.
The
cooperation with the SEC, I might say, was very good. The chairman. I mean, I always had a good relationship with the chairman of the SEC during that period as well. Hamer Budge was chairman during part of that. With the SEC staff, they were terrific. I remember John Evans, who was a commissioner, that a lot of people in the Wall Street community did not like. John Evans was terrific, and so forth. And the New York Stock Exchange continued to support that legislation and urged its signing by President Ford, which he did sign, although many of the firms opposed it strenuously.
At the outset, though, you said that it was...
It was a disaster. It was a disaster.
How much was that due to the SEC shaping the initial legislation?
A lot of it, yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And it was done through, for example, on the membership issue, they had a hearing, and one of the key members of the Moss subcommittee was Congressman Bob Eckhart from Texas. It was a Democrat. And I remember I testified, and I had a memo prepared by Milbank Tweed, which was the outside lawyers for the New York Stock Exchange during this whole period, who were terrific, by the way. I mean, just to mention, there's a fellow by the name of Sam Rosenberry who represented the New York Stock Exchange for years, and his associate was Floyd Brandau. And then on at one point, there were 100 and some antitrust and other suits against the New York Stock Exchange, all of which Bill Jackson and Ike Shapiro, who were the lawyers. Bill Jackson was the son of Justice Jackson. And his, there were Bill Jackson and Ike Shapiro, their interesting story about them. But anyhow, they successfully defended the New York Stock Exchange in all these antitrust cases, among others. One of the antitrust cases involving the Adelot firms went to the Supreme Court twice on the definition of a class action and so forth. So you had that going on at the same time. But on the membership issue, Milbank Tweed produced a memo that essentially said that the Congress could not take away property rights, you know, without providing compensation. And I appeared before this hearing, and Congressman Eckhart listened to this, and I remember him saying to John Moss, you know, he's right, we can't do this. And Moss said to me, okay, how much will it cost to buy these people out? And I said, well, I can't answer that. And he said, well, I want an answer for the record. I said, I can't answer, I mean, how, you know, we can't answer that, and so forth. So that provision was dropped because of Eckhart.
Well, wouldn't you figure that out by seeing what a seat is worth at that particular point? Is that the cost you're talking about, is buying everybody's seat?
You could do it that way, I suppose, yeah. We didn't want to do it that way.
Well, we're talking about legislation, and I want to track back a little bit. The 60s, we're looking at the big conglomerate movement, Gulf and Western and all those companies. And I know that there was a run-up to the Williams Act, which was essentially looking at how you can counter these sorts of takeovers.
That's right. The Williams Act, what the background there is that the New York Stock Exchange for years had had its own regulations on takeovers and tender offers. There was no federal legislation, nor was there any state requirements. And working with Senator Williams and his staff, Steve Paradise, among others, was developed the Williams Bill, which was the takeover legislation, which still exists today. And that was a cooperative. Yes, I was deeply involved in that.
And were you again working with the SEC?
And the SEC staff as well, yes, yes. Throughout, I might say, the relationship with the SEC staff was always very good. I mean, we had Sam Lyons down there, and Sam was the type of person that everybody liked. He was non-political. He wasn't confrontational. He was a reporter, and he would report what's going on and so forth. He knew more of what was going on at the SEC than the chairman probably did, because he spent his whole day roaming the halls and talking to people and so forth, schmoozing, right? And so the relationship was always good with the staff. There were Shelley Rappaport, I remember, was very good on the staff down there. I mean, the staff and the commissioners were always open, always willing to listen and so forth. It was not, the very few points was it adversarial. Over fixed commission rates, it got very adversarial. That's a whole other story. Al Sommer was down there. Ray Garrett, when he was chairman, I knew his father, Ray Garrett Sr. His father would come to me when I was the Illinois Securities Commissioner. That's how I met Ray Garrett, and Ray became chairman. And it was always a good relationship. There were a lot of things that they didn't like, a lot of things we didn't like, right? I mean, but it was a common effort. I might say during this period, I was also involved with the business law section of the American Bar Association, who were really outstanding business lawyers, and I became chairman of the State Regulation and Securities Committee of the ABA, and would go to the meetings of the Council of the Business Law Section, and this was always headed by fantastic people like Al Sommer was the chairman. That's how I got to know Al Sommer. That's long before he became a commissioner. And a matter of fact, one of the things that I did, which I still do today, by the way, is that when we even after we reorganized the board, which is another story which we haven't talked about, but the problem had always been, in my view and a view of a lot of others, is that how do you get input into an organization like the New York Stock Exchange? I mean, we had different constituent groups. There were the members on the floor. There were the upstairs members. There was the public investors. There was the SEC. There was we haven't mentioned the state of New York, but we had a lot of problems with that. My God, did we have problems with the state of New York?
And that was good business, too.
Yeah, but anyhow, so what we did is when Jim Needham was chairman, which is a whole other story, we created this, he agreed to create this, these advisory committees I'd suggested. The first one was a capital markets advisory committee, and this was headed by Bob Roussa, who was then a partner at Brown Brothers Harriman, had been in the U.S. Treasury as one of the top officials there. And we got top people from the Wall Street firms that, that did the international business, which was then developing, which is a whole nother story about internationalization. But we created the, and one of the advisory committees we created was a legal advisory committee. And of all the lawyers that dealt with the New York Stock Exchange, it was hard to pick people. And so what we decided to do was to name the past chairman of the section of business law of the American Bar Association to that committee. And the first chairman was Mendes Hirschman. Mendes Hirschman was the, among other things, the counsel for, general counsel for New York Life. And Mendes Hirschman was a terrific guy, had been chairman of the section. And all of the members of that committee were former chairman of that section, which included Ray Garrett, which chaired that section. And that's how we created the Legal Advisory Committee. And initially, it reported to the chairman, who was Jim Needham. And then one day, Jim Needham decided he didn't want any more, and he fired them all. But then we got a new chairman at the New York Stock Exchange by the name of Mel Batten. And he saw the merit to this. And so the New York Stock Exchange still, the last I checked a year ago, has 8 advisory committees to the board, which is a, and the purpose of that was to get input from these different people as to what the exchange ought to be doing and so forth beyond what you got from the board.
Well, you touched on the thing that was next on my list, and it's a big subject, and let's cover that and then jump back to some of these stories that you talked about, and that is commission rates.
Right.
Was this, I think there was some discussion about this coming out of the special study.
That's right.
How did this rise to the level of a pretty hot issue? In that, you know, 68, you had the hearings, the SEC's hearings on commission rates.
Right, well, Gene Rotberg. Yeah. Right. Well, what happened, well, I mean, a lot of things happened, but one thing that happened, which was a seminal thing, is Bob Hack, when he was president of the exchange, got invited to address the New York Economic Club in September. And as I mentioned before,
1970?
Yes, thereabouts. He was the president and CEO of the exchange. He was from Robert W. Baird Company, Milwaukee, and the NESD, and he never quite fit in with the New York Stock Exchange for some reason. He never moved to New York. He lived in Potomac, outside of Washington. And he was a very thoughtful guy, very articulate, and those were his real strengths. And plus, he was very knowledgeable, having run a brokerage firm in Milwaukee all those years and been involved with the NESD all those years. And during that summer, he did like Keith Funston did. He took the month of August off. They all took the month of August off. And he came. He called me one day in August, and he said, "You know, he's in Washington, right? He had an apartment here in New York." And he said, "I'm coming up to New York, and I'd like for you to meet me at the airport or something, and I want to show you something." And I said, "Fine." So we get into the car, and he hands me this speech. And in this speech to the Economic Club, he calls for the abolition of fixed commission rates. And in the speech, he attacks the New York Stock Exchange board for not agreeing to do it, which he had not proposed to them. Right?
Yeah.
But if he did, they wouldn't have done it. And I said to him, he said, "What do you think?" And I said, well, first of all, I wouldn't make it personal. I mean, why do you have to attack the vice chairman of the board, who was Bunny Lasker, who was a $2 broker on the floor? I mean, I said, you know, if you, you know, you can, I said, you know, reading the speech, I'm not going to be like talk you out of making the speech, obviously. He said, "No way are you going to talk me out." I said, "But you need to tone it down. I mean, you need to talk in an objective way. I mean, if you want to make your case, don't make it emotional. Make it objective." And that he did do. And he did make the speech. And it made the front page of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And it got a lot of people fired. Not of least of which was the executive vice president exchange in those days. And the then chairman of the board was Ralph DeNunzio, Kidder Peabody. He was a great guy. And that was the end of Bob Hack. I mean, he knew it. I mean, it was a self-destructive act, but he was a man of principle. He felt very strongly about this. He lived in Washington, and he heard all the talk at the SEC over the years and from the commissioners, and including Al Sommer, who was a big advocate of negotiated rates and a good friend of Bob's, and so forth. And so then the controversy really began. I mean, that was the beginning of the end at that point.
Yeah, well, the middle of the beginning was the 68 commission rate hearings.
Right.
And I think that there was somebody from the stock exchange who was number one witness. I can't remember the name.
Well,
Fulton,
who?
Fulton, maybe? I can't remember the guy's name.
No, well, there was Erwin Stelzer. Remember Erwin Stelzer? Remember Erwin?
I remember the name.
Yeah, Erwin Stelzer headed up a consulting firm, and they had done a lot of studies on the impact of it and so forth. And Erwin today is in London and writes for the, he's still an economist in London, writes on political and economic matters in London. And he had a terrific team. They were the third party advocates that the New York Stock Exchange had hired. You know, to try and approach it objectively rather than emotionally, which it was primarily emotionally. But the opposition came primarily from, well, there was what happened after Bob Hack left the exchange. Then you had the reorganization of the board, which is a whole other story. That was done by Bill Martin.
Is that directly afterwards?
It was about the same time. It was around that time, 1972. It was in that period,
okay.
Right? And the board then hired Jim Needham, which is another story where I was involved. And Jim Needham had been an advocate for negotiated rates as a SEC commissioner. And we had a membership meeting at the Chase Bank down the street here, I remember. And at that membership meeting, Jim Needham announced to the world that while he was in favor of negotiated rates, now was not the time to do so when the industry was in a depressed condition and he got a standing ovation and so forth. And that was, I remember Dick Rustin, whom I knew at the Wall Street Journal, said that he threw down the gauntlet. It was the iron fist in the silver, in the silk glove or something like that. I mean, that was really the confrontation came about as a result of Jim Needham and that speech and so forth.
Bill Casey's a commissioner in there too in the early 70s.
Casey was the chairman, and Casey's the one that got Jim Needham named chairman of the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay.
Indirectly, I mean, mm-hmm. he was involved, and it was done. Don Regan was the moving force at that time. Don Regan was the chairman of Merrill Lynch. And there was a board meeting in San Francisco around that time where Don Regan got the board to vote to abolish fixed commission rates. Then we had another meeting the following week, and they reversed themselves. Needham was
what
the chairman.
What happened in between?
Well, the firms rallied, and so forth. I mean, it was, they got to the other members of the board, I suppose.
Members like Merrill Lynch would have been in favor of unfixing commission rates.
Well, Merrill Lynch, it was interesting. During fixed commission rates, they had a cost and revenues committee. And I sat in on all those meetings. And that's where they fixed the rates. And usually Merrill Lynch would come in and publicly say that they were opposed to a rate increase. And then at the meeting privately say they wanted a rate increase. And in those days also, this is before the 75 Act amendments, the New York Stock Exchange could change their rules with impunity. One of the things that Keith Funston and Duke Chapman had worked out with the SEC staff was that if there was a letter agreement whereby if the exchange was going to change commission rates, they would give the SEC like 30 days notice before they did so. But they didn't have to. The law didn't require that. it was just an agreement to, and at the end of the 30 days, you could do whatever you wanted. And we did that with alder rules. That's, we got incorporated, for example, on midnight of the 30th day, and before the SEC could do anything about it. But anyhow, the commission rate debates were the firms themselves wanted to keep fixed rates, obviously, and so they would publicly come out in favor of negotiated rates, but privately they were urging us to fight. You know.
You said things got pretty heated with the SEC at that.
Yes, it was emotional on both sides. I mean, the firms were emotional about it because a lot of these firms saw that they would be forced out of business, which they were. And nobody knew what the new negotiated rates would lead to. Gus Levy, for example, at Goldman Sachs announced one day that, you know, Goldman Sachs were going to charge 2 cents a trade or some figure like that. And that lasted for like 5 minutes because then other firms would come along and say, well, we're, you know, and so forth. So there was no bottom.
Yeah.
We found that out. But the other issue during this time was the antitrust cases as well, you know, that the Department of Justice was involved and so forth. They had a whole investigation underway.
Tell me a little bit about that. How did that start?
Well, that started because of fixed rates primarily. And also the exclusion on membership. I mean, institutions could not become members. I mean, institution being if you were not a partnership, right? I was the staff guy on the public ownership committee, which was headed by Pat Rockefeller and Dominic and Dominic at the time. And they'd had a committee for several years looking into whether they would allow firms to be publicly owned. And they never did anything. I was not involved at that point in time. And then when Dan Lufkin of Donaldson Lufkin Jenrette became a director, again, this is a 34-person board, and he stands up at the board meeting and announces that Donaldson Lufkin's going public and walks out of the meeting, right? So then I was asked, would you do the staff work with Pat Rockefeller on the committee, on the public ownership committee? And I looked at what they had done, and they never made a decision as to whether they favored public ownership or not. So I did a whole list. I did a list of questions. I remember we got the 20 questions and asked them a question, question after question. By answering the questions, they developed the policies that were then implemented and adopted and allowed public ownership.
Was this around?
Took like 6 months to do it once they get.
Was this around the time of the transition when the 34 went down to 22 and left?
No, that came later. The public ownership was before that. What happened that during the pendency of the House legislation, there was criticism about in the special study about that some members of the board had been on the board for 20 some years, it was dominated by the specialists and the floor traders, all of which was true. I mean, there was no denying that. And that they controlled the board and controlled the institution, which was true. I mean, it was not arguable. I mean, you could argue it, but you weren't right, right? And something needed to be done, and then the question of who could do it. And there were discussions. Bunny Lasker was then chairman. Ralph D'Annunzio was vice chairman. And discussions about what to do. And I think I was the one that suggested, why not ask Bill Martin, who had just left the Fed, to do a study on institutional ownership. And he had changed the place back in the 40s. You know, why couldn't, and would he do it? And he agreed to do it. But it was on the narrow question of institutional ownership. And then as he got into it, he broadened the question, and he thought that the board should be reorganized, and he then proposed this reorganization of the board.
Oh, okay.
That's how it came about, through a sort of a backdoor way. I mean, he was such a distinguished person and a marvelous personality, you know, to work with him and so forth. And he came up with this, and nobody really objected to it. And it was that you'd have 10 public directors, 10 industry directors, and a full-time chairman and CEO. And he said he patterned this after the Federal Reserve boards, which I assume is true. I don't know whether they're organized that way, but that's what he came up with. And they bought it. It was like a non-event in terms the board supported it. Ralph D'Annunzio was then chairman, and he implemented it. He presided at the board, and then there was a question of who would be the full-time CEO. And they talked to a lot of people. They offered it to some members of the board who turned it down, and they were running into this was the old board. It was still the old board. The new board didn't come in until like August, and they were running out of time. And there was a meeting held, which I was invited to, and one of the prominent members of the board, with Ralph D'Annunzio objecting strenuously, told that he had lined up the votes to offer the job to Jim Needham.
William McChesney Martin study. I didn't know that he recommended the restructuring.
Yes.
But the big issue the one that made the papers, I think, had to do with the institutional membership and the effects of Rule 390.
Right.
Which is something you haven't mentioned at all.
Yeah, well, 390, I lived with 390 for a long time.
In fact,
it was originally Rule 394. Duke Chevin and I changed the numbers, so we got so tired of talking about Rule 394.
Okay, well, now I know who to blame because it's really confusing.
It just disappeared one day.
Yeah. Were you drawing up a new list?
Well, there were changes were made. There were changes made where you could do transactions off the floor.
Okay.
And that's when the renumbering, then we renumbered it.
We were talking about the importance of the special study, and the SEC had also done the institutional investor study.
Right.
And I think it was probably before the Martin study.
That's right. That's right.
Was that in any way, designed to address the SEC study?
Well, the institutional investor study came about in a different way, and the special study was primarily lawyers. There were a few economists involved, but it was a lawyers-like study. And it was a lot of SEC staff were involved in that, people that ultimately moved from the special study onto the SEC staff, and there were a lot of SEC staff input to it. The institutional study was all economists for the most part. They had some lawyers there, but the head of the study was an economist and so forth, and they were looking at the impact of institutions on the market was a primary thing. And I think they started out with the theory that, I think I was on the advisory group or something to that study.
Oh, okay.
The economists started out with the theory that the institutions had this herd instinct and they all would do the same thing at the same time, and therefore they had a profound influence on the market. So they did all these studies, and that wasn't the fact, right? So it was one of these things where you start out with the assumption that this is what it is, but it turns out that's not. Now, what do you do about it? So it kind of drifted as a result of that.
How did 390 have to do with the institutional investor question? Because they're linked somehow.
Well, it was linked in that 390 was challenged by the Department of Justice, as well as restrictions on membership, as well as fixed commission rates. I mean, those were the big issues. And 390 was, the Department of Justice viewed it as an anti-competitive type of restriction in that you couldn't take a transaction off the exchange but of course the big exception, you could take it to another exchange, right? And at that time you had the third market, Don Whedon and Alan Whedon and a lot of other people who were complaining about the exchange. There was this banking firm here in New York. I can't think of the name of the firm offhand, but they were very close to Congressman Seller, who was head of the antitrust subcommittee in the House, and he was a great protagonist of the exchange over Rule 390, which didn't allow these. It didn't allow the member firms to go to these off non-exchange member firms like the firms that traded in bank securities. Bank securities had not been listed on the New York Stock Exchange. That's a whole other thing. I was involved in that. Is that there were no bank stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and I was involved in a led a series of discussions with the then controller of the currency, Jim Saxon, to change the controller of the currency rules to allow banks to be listed. You know.
Were you successful?
Yes, we're successful. Yeah.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I mean, one of the banks to be listed, banks were traded over the counter by these banking, I can't think of the name, Feiler Schmidt, was it? But this firm, that there were firms that made markets in bank stocks, and bank stocks were not traded on the New York or any other stock exchange. And there were restrictions imposed by the controller of the currency and by the Fed, but primarily by the controller of the currency, which did not allow them to list. And we worked with some people from primarily from Citibank to change this, as well as with the controller. And then 390 became a big focus then, because not only were bank stocks now being listed, but Merrill Lynch, for example, could not trade a bank stock with these non-member firms that specialized in trading bank stocks. So they got very irritated, justifiably so, right?
How about, I understand that it was also wrapped up in the idea of givebacks.
Well, that's the commission rates where you had the four-way tickets.
These are all bundled up.
Yeah, well, they were all bundled up from the antitrust standpoint. But we successfully, Bill Jackson and Ike Shapiro and others, successfully defended all those antitrust suits, you know, on the basis that there was this California grape cases whereby if the regulatory authority has the authority to do something, that's a per se exemption from the antitrust laws. They were successful on that argument time and time again. So the Department of Justice people were justifiably frustrated in trying to attack the place, and these obviously were restraints of trade. There was no question about that. It's just a question whether it was exempt from the antitrust laws, which it was.
Well, and Rule 390 also gets into this whole issue of market structure and what the market's going to look like. And one of the things Martin said was, you know, that we're going to have fragmentation, and people are going to take their trades out of Wall Street, and the system as we know it can fall apart.
Well, during this period, you had Weeden and Company, which was a third market firm, which is not a member of the New York Stock Exchange, didn't want to be a member of the New York Stock Exchange. And they traded NYSE listed stocks off the New York Stock Exchange and did very well at that. And the problem that they had, though, is that the 390 did not allow the member firms to deal with them directly. They had to do it indirectly somehow. And that's where the rub came in on the 390 for it. And then the institutions, and then they also were not bound by the fixed commission rate schedule. I mean, so some institutions would like to have traded with these firms and did trade with these firms at a lower rate than the fixed commission rate. So you got that bound into it. So they all were bound together. And then at the same time, you had the regional exchanges were out there who were, what happened to the regionals was that they no longer were trading local stocks. That's like, take for example, the Midwest Stock Exchange in Chicago. At one point, their primary market was in local listed companies, like the local utilities and so forth. Well, as the New York Stock Exchange grew, it took those companies listed in New York, and therefore the volume moved to New York. And then these firms, under the multiple trading cases back in the 1930s, these exchanges could trade stocks listed in New York if they filed an application to do so with the SEC. So it turned out they were direct competitors to the NYSE, and they no longer were local markets. I mean, the name regional was a misnomer because they were competitive markets as they are today.
So they're really national markets.
And that's why we call the National Stock Exchange, of which I'm the chairman, right?
Right.
Got it.
I want to fill in the space between that and the National Stock Exchange.
But I might say throughout all of this, there was never, I mean, both personally and professionally, always had good relationships with the SEC commissioners and staff. I mean, most of the commissioners we're personal friends, with my wife and family. I mean, I remember Hamer Budge, a wife and our daughter, would go to his apartment in Washington and swam in the pool together and so forth. And Al Sommer was a great friend, and his wife and star and so forth. Ray Garrett, I mean, Manny Cohen and so forth. I mean, there was not an antagonistic relationship. I mean, it was there were honest disagreements on how to proceed. And what we were trying to do is to create an institution that was for the betterment of the country. I mean, you know, I'm from the Midwest. I had no particular affection for New York as such, right? I used to say I was doing missionary work here, but now I've been 40 years. But the New York Stock Exchange has a great contribution to make to the economy and the wealth of this country. And that's what we were trying to do, right? And there were problems there, and you're trying to get away from the focus for the benefit of the private club type of mentality. And I think we changed that. Because when I came there, it clearly was a private club, no question about that. I mean, it was an unincorporated association, just like golf clubs were and so forth. You know, it was dominated by a small group of people and so forth. And that was changed over the years.
The 75 amendments, that whole process, we came to the thing they called the national market system.
Right.
At least I think the legislation said that the SEC should take a look and try to, you know, come up with the outline of the national market system.
Well, it set out, which it still does, a series of objectives that are to be met, some of which are inconsistent with others. But
what did the New York Stock Exchange, what was its position when this message was put out?
Well, we worked very closely with the Senate and House staffs and the SEC staff and supported that legislation.
Okay.
As I mentioned before, a lot of the member firms and a lot of the floor, the specialist firms, ultimately were opposed to it and didn't want the president to sign it. And we supported it to the end and throughout. I mean,
so you
once
didn't
we
find
reached
yourself opposing your member firms.
Yes, but there was no way that they were going to prevail because we'd worked so closely with the House and Senate staffs that, and they were very accommodating and they're very understanding, and it was both sides of the aisle. There was a lot of support from the Republican Senate. Congressman Broyhill was terrific. He was the ranking minority member of the Moss subcommittee. John Moss's staff were great people to work with. It was not a partisan effort on any side, but a lot of these firms had a lot of influence with different members of the committees. But the problem areas were all worked out.
But there must have been a sense from what you're describing that this thing is going to go. You probably need to be on board in some respect.
Well, what happens when you get into it, just like the immigration legislation now, once you get into it in Washington, it builds its own momentum, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's very hard to stop that momentum,
right?
And therefore, either you get aboard or you're discarded. You're irrelevant to the discussion. What we did is we remained relevant to the discussion. I mean, we participated the whole time. I mean, if there's something that we didn't like, we would suggest a change and try and work it out, and that's what was done.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that the exchange did after that to stay relevant to the discussion, as far as implementing new technology, new systems, ITS, for example.
Yes.
That it seems as if that was sort of the first big attempt by the exchange to cope with the, you know,
right,
electronic reality.
That's right. That's correct. Right.
Was this something that you had a role in?
Yes. Yes. And it was ITS was again the ITS was developed while the legislation was being developed,
mm-hmm.
right? And one thing that everyone agreed to is that there should be a linking of the markets. As I said, the regionals have gone from regional exchanges to national exchanges, right? And they were trading the same things in Chicago and San Francisco as they were trading in New York and in Boston. And therefore, there should be obviously a linkage to the market. One of the early things was the consolidated tape. the New York Stock Exchange owned the tape, and one of the things that came out of the paperwork crisis I might mention was SIAC, Securities Industry Automation Corporation, and SIAC produced the tape, right, and therefore rather than have separate tapes, that is dissemination of prices in quotes, they have one, and this the regionals thought, with some justification, that if that happened, business would be diverted from New York to the regionals in a great amount, right? And the same way with the quotation system, that this was the end of the New York Stock Exchange. Well, it was, you know.
Exchange is doing this.
The exchange did it. The exchange agreed. It was very controversial within the exchange, but I mean, the exchange did it. Floyd Brando was the one and his associates at Milbank tweeted most of the drafting of these things. They were terrific as being professionals, lawyers, objective lawyers, although they had a client, and so forth. And the regionals, it was a great thing for the regionals because what it did is, what it led to, in the case of ITS, what it gave the regionals is regionals got access to the NYSE market. Prior to that, prior to ITS, the saying was you had to come in the front door. In other words, if you had a transaction, if a specialist in Chicago on the Midwest Stock Exchange had a transaction in AT&T and the other side was in New York and he wasn't a member of the New York Stock Exchange, he had to give that order to a member of the New York Stock Exchange who came in the front door and executed that order. What ITS did is ITS let that firm get access to that order in New York without being a member, right? And therefore, you did have a linkage of the market. So if there was a better price in Chicago than there was in New York, that order could be executed in Chicago. And so they had a better opportunity to compete. The bottom line was is that ultimately, New York lost very little business. I mean, there were estimates as to the – internally, there were huge estimates as to the amount of business lost, all of which proved to be wrong.
Why not, as you said, the ITS linked the markets themselves? Why not link the brokers so that if a broker wants to execute, you go right to the computer and you put in your order.
Well, that's where 390 came in, is you could do that if you were a member. Well, 390 required you to bring the order to the floor.
Right.
The floor of an exchange, right? And that so therefore you couldn't go direct to Merrill Lynch couldn't go direct to Kidder Peabody or it couldn't go direct to Wheaton and Company. It had to come to the exchange. And then once it did that, then that order could go wherever through ITS. That's what ITS changed. So it provided access to the various markets as well as linking the markets. The New York specialist, who was not a member of the Midwest Stock Exchange, he could go out there and reach to that order as well, right? So the assumption was with the consolidated tape, consolidated quote, and ITS, New York Stock Exchange in big trouble. Ended up, they got 90% of the market.
That's often the case when it looks like things are going to be terrible with some new technology or a new system. The people who are screaming the loudest turn out to benefit the most.
Right, but New York, we did a lot of other things that what they call today, we didn't call it that then, which built the brand. I mean, the advisory committees were a big help to that. I mean, we got people like Al Sommer became chairman of the legal advisory committee right after he left the commission. The top institutional money managers, we had an institutional advisory committee. I mean, these people had input. They weren't on the board, but on the board we had the head of TAI Cref, Bill Greenough, was on the board. He was a big critic of the place. He's now on the board, right? He's got as much to say as anybody else, and he said it, right? And we listened to him. So all these other things happened. And the other thing that we did was to try and create the image. Here's a private company that, until we incorporated, as I said before, was a private association. But even after we incorporated as a not-for-profit corporation, it was owned by the 1,366 members, right? But we tried to build the image, which was the fact that this institution is bigger than that. And so one way of doing that was we had a series of conferences, one of which was at Harvard, on productivity. In those days, Ezra Vogel had written a book, Japan is Number One, and we got to know Ezra, and primarily through Ezra and the dean at the Harvard Fine Arts College, wasn't a business school, We organized this conference on Henry Ruskovsky. Ruskovsky, I'll get a name wrong. Henry Ruskovsky, I think. That we organized this conference on productivity with Harvard. So here you got the New York Stock Exchange talking about productivity, right? And to that conference, we would attract people like Jack Welch, you know, the top corporate leaders in the country. And they were worried about productivity in this country at the time. The top labor leaders were there.
We're talking about the 1980s here?
Yeah, yeah. And that was a conscious effort. We then organized a conference with at Oxford, with the Templeton School of Business at Oxford, on different things. Then we organized a conference in Beijing with the People's Bank of China on organizing capital markets in China.
Did you develop a lot of international experience while you were still with the...
Yes, that's where I got to where I am today, is that along the line, among the things I eventually became, when Mill Batten became, after Jim Needham, which is a whole other story, you know, Jim Needham was fired by the board summarily and so forth, and Mill Batten, who was then, had just retired as the chairman of JCPenney and Company, where he had spent his whole career, he was the head of the business council, probably the most respected CEO in America at the time. Very nice, marvelous man in every way. And he was on the board as one of those 10 public directors that came in after the Martin reorganization. One of the things he did when he retired from JCPenney is a study of the allocation of stock system and the quality of markets and so forth. So he did a report which led to creation of the Quality of Markets Committee and an allocation committee so that allocations are made objectively with input from the listed companies, which hadn't happened before, that there was a measure of the quality of the market that was being provided by the exchange through the specialists and the brokers, which had never been done before. He had just concluded that study, and there was a lot of unhappiness on the board with Jim Needham for a lot of other reasons and so forth. And they then asked, Mill Batten was asked, would he take the job? And he said, yes. And then when he came in, one of the things that he appreciated, Mill Batten was from West Virginia, Reedy, West Virginia, right? You can take the boy out of Reedy, but you can't take the Reedy out of the boy type thing. He went to school at Ohio State, right? He went to a reunion at Ohio State. Here he's the chairman of the business council, chairman of JCPenney and Company, and they asked him at the alumni meeting, what do you do? And he said, I'm a rag merchant. Everybody's like, modest guy. He was terrific. Well, anyhow, he saw, you know, the coming from the outside like I did, he saw that this institution was really important to this country, right? And it was in all these ITS would just happen. He was involved in creating ITS, by the way. He came in at the time after the legislation had passed, or as it was about to pass and so forth. And he saw that, you know, that this institution was important for America. And he had relationships with all these CEOs, and he talked to them. We had created a listed company advisory committee that Raleigh Warner, the chairman of Mobil Oil, was the chairman. Jim Robinson, the chairman of American Express, succeeded him. And these top CEOs would spend their time trying to help the New York Stock Exchange because they began, through Mill Batten, they appreciated that this institution was important to them and to their way of life.
Right?
Right? And that's what kept the business there.
Yeah. And it has succeeded in the word you used earlier, branding itself,
I proposed to Bob Hack one time, and he gave me this look that, you know, like, you got to be crazy, Calvin, that we run commercials on TV, which they'd never done, right? And that the commercials be, remember Chevrolet had Apple Pie, America, and Chevrolet, and I said we should have Apple Pie, America, Chevrolet, and the New York Stock Exchange. He said, get out of here. But that's what they ended up doing, though. I mean, you know, because it is true. It is bigger than the group of people that controlled it. And these people saw that. They were big enough to see that. The specialists on the floor, those people, Walter Frank, and there are a lot of others of them, who had been a chairman of the exchange, they recognized this, and rather than resist it, they supported it. And it was against their immediate interest, but in their long-term interest. There are a lot of things that they could have done that they didn't do, but there are a lot of things that they did that they needed to do, and it succeeded.
So we're going to talk about internationalization.
Well, yes. What happened during the process when Mill Batten came in? I was, among other things, I became executive vice president of the exchange, and we had one of the things I'd recommended to Mill, and he agreed. We created an office of the chairman, which is the chairman, the vice chairman, who was then the head of Merrill Lynch for a while, was the vice chairman, the head of Reynolds and Company. They were top people in the industry. Roger Burke was the head of Merrill Lynch at that time. Don Regan was the vice chairman. And so you had the chairman, the vice chairman, and then there were two. Bob Hall was an executive vice president. When he left, Don Cattell and I became executive vice presidents. Then Don Cattell left, and I was the only executive vice president there for a while. And then we created a management committee, which was the top managers with ourselves and so forth. And one of the areas that reported to me was the... what was the listing area. And Mill Batten, having come from JCPenney, where they had umpteen thousand products, was always uncomfortable with the fact that the New York Stock Exchange had one product, listed stocks. They had a bond trading thing where they did in cabinets, right? And one of the things he wanted to do was to create a futures market and an options market, which he did proceed to do, and diversify and so forth. And one of the things in my looking when I first got involved with the listing area, they kept a tabulation of the eligible companies, and they tried to maintain liaison or try and contact these companies. I say try. I mean, there's some interesting stories about that, what they call trying. But there wasn't a real marketing effort as such, and that was expanded. In fact, Mill made it into a marketing department rather than a listing department. I mean, the difference was the listing people were regulators. They had all these regulations that they had developed, many of which predated the takeover area. That's what they administered, right? All these listing standards, delisting standards, all that type of stuff. And they would maintain liaison with these companies who had entered into a contract with the exchange, right? It's a contractual relationship. And that's why the list comes from the contract, the list comes from the old markets when you got onto the list. And in turn for assuming these obligations and paying this money to the New York Stock Exchange fees, the company got this market for their stock. And so it was a semi-regulatory function, was just as important, more so than marketing. Well, anyhow, he changed that to marketing. And in looking at the eligible number of companies one day, realized that there were more non-U.S. companies that were eligible for listing than there were U.S. companies. And they were companies all over the world that weren't listed here. There were a few, and one of the things we did is we created an international advisory committee. An interesting story. The first non-U.S. company to list on the New York Stock Exchange was KLM Airlines. And the chairman of KLM Airlines that I got to know through friends in Amsterdam was a fellow by the name of Sergio Orlandini, who was Italian, right? Dutch airline, Italian, right? And he was married to a nice woman from Connecticut. So he was terrific. And I met Sergio with a friend in his home outside of Amsterdam, and he's the chairman of the first foreign company. And so we approached Sergio to become chairman of the listed international advisory committee. And then he said, who's on the committee? And said, that's where we need you, Sergio, to get all these people. We want people on the committee that are not listed, for the most part. So we got the chairman of UBS, Bob Studer, who was terrific. We got the chairman of BMW, and so forth and so on. It became a fantastic, and which still exists today, by the way. And what became apparent is that the New York Stock Exchange should be looking primarily to list these non-U.S. companies as well as the U.S. companies. The U.S. companies would kind of naturally flow in, and that's why they didn't have any marketing. They would list first on the Amex, and then they would graduate to a New York listing. That was the domestic route. It was over-the-counter, Amex, and then New York. And so you had this steady flow coming in that way, but the international company, there was nothing coming. And that's where the growth was. And that's why I got
you also had over-the-counter was becoming more attractive. too. NASDAQ was growing up, and companies were choosing to stay with NASDAQ, weren't they?
That's right. Well, but that affected the Amex more than it affected us, because the progression was through NASD through Amex to New York, and the Amex unfortunately lost that.
Well, anything else we should cover before we talk about your retirement from the exchange? We've sort of gotten ourselves into the 1980s here.
We're up to the 1980s? Yeah. But I want to emphasize again that the thing, that my memories of the SEC staff have always been fond ones. I don't have a bad memory where there was some incident or something. I mean, we were always willing, always able to work with those people. And it was a changing population there, you know, the people coming and going. They were always extremely competent people, still are today. I mean, that was the saving grace to this. It was not a confrontational relationship.
Did you see the commission change over time, though, from 64 when you're first engaged with them to 87?
Well, in terms of people, it changed, but in terms of attitude, it didn't change much. I mean, you had, when Richard Breeden came in, that was a big change. He'd come out of the White House, if you remember, and so forth. But his relationships, that was during the time there was something that came up, what was audit committees. Richard Breeden was involved, you know, there was pressure in the Congress to do audit committees, and he prevailed upon the chairman of the exchange for the New York Stock Exchange to institute audit committees rather than having it be mandated by the SEC. I mean, that's one of the things, the issues of the day. But it showed the working relationship. It was always a good relationship. When Dave Reuter was there in 87, which is, I left in 80, my timing was perfect. I left in the end of January 87.
Okay.
But Dave was then chairman of the SEC at that time, and what happened in 87, fortunately, I was not there.
Yeah, I was going to want to ask you about that. I talked to Robert Birnbaum, who was a very memorable day.
Yeah. Well, they didn't handle things very well.
So why did you decide to retire from me?
Well, what happened to me is that, backing up a moment, back when I first came there, Keith Funston was still there. Keith Funston found out about this International Federation of Stock Exchanges, which was a European exchanges headquartered in Paris. In French was Fédération Internationale Bourse des Valeurs, that's FIBV. And he somehow, this is before, about the time that I arrived there, this happened, he somehow got the New York Stock Exchange a membership in that organization. It was the first non-European exchange. And they had an annual meeting in September, and it was in Geneva, and Duke Chapman was the representative that he went with Keith Funston to that meeting. And then Duke left the exchange shortly thereafter, and I inherited that relationship. So I then went to all of the subsequent meetings of the FIBV. And as that organization grew and had a big role to play in it. And so I got to know all these people. I knew all the top people at every exchange around the world on a personal basis. I mean, the wife and I in 1974, for example, we went to a meeting in South Africa of the International Federation. We went all over the world and met all these people. I got to know the heads of the Tokyo Stock Exchange on a very personal basis, their families, very interesting stories. I mean, these people talked about the war and the kamikaze pilots and whatever. I mean, it was fantastic. And the people throughout the world, literally, and they became friends. And they, from time to time, they would call on me or the exchange to be of assistance, which we would try to do. One time, for example, I went to Kuwait. And then I went to Abu Dhabi and so forth. I would only go for a few days to try and help those people out and so forth. And that was very interesting. Among the people I got involved with were the Swiss. The fellow that headed the Association of Swiss Stock Exchanges and also was chairman of the Geneva Stock Exchange. He wanted to organize a derivatives market in Switzerland. That is an options and a futures market. And at that time, there were about six stock exchanges in Switzerland, all which were very competitive. And so he, I arranged for meetings for him in New York and so forth and so on. And he ended up, rather than creating a, rather than doing this in Geneva, where he would have liked to have done it, he organized what was called SOFIX, the Swiss Options and Futures, Financial Futures Exchange, which today is Eurex. And I got to know him very well, both on a personal basis. George Urban is his name, terrific guy. And when I left the exchange, he asked me to become his advisor. So I became the advisor to the, for 10 years or more. And I, the same thing happened with Kuala Lumpur and other exchanges around the world, as Sao Paulo. I mean, there are stories in all of them which continue to today. And I've been advisor to more than 18 exchange chairmen around the world in the last 20, now it's 21 years, still am.
What's the common thread in all of those relationships?
Well, what I've done in all the relationships, with one or two exceptions, which didn't work out. So all of the relationships I have, with one or two exceptions, were with the chairman and or the CEO. In all of those, and it's just true today, because I just spent 2 days in meetings in Chicago with the chairman of the Cairo Stock Exchange, where I've been the advisor for 10 years now. I'm on my fourth chairman there. All of these people, Cairo is a good example. The same thing was true in Geneva 20 years ago. The chairman was, the chairman had to serve his constituency, whether it's the members or the government or both. He had to deal with the government, and he had to deal with the staff, and he had to deal with technical matters as well as, call them, political constituent matters. And therefore, he's isolated to a large degree, right? Because he can't go to one constituency and say, what do you want me to do? Because it conflicts with another constituency or with the government or what the staff wants to do. So he's an arbiter. He's a, call him a politician in the best sense of the word. And therefore, he's always looking, what should I do, right? And I call myself, that's what I've done for 21 years, I'm an advisor to these people. I'm not a consultant. I'm an advisor. And I give them my advice. Most times, they don't do it. They take the advice, but they don't do it, right? They want to do it, but it takes time for them to do it. I can give you 100 examples of that. Well, just one recently, take Cairo, for example. That several years ago, my second chairman, who was a fantastic guy. But all these people, by the way, are fantastic people. I mean, to get to that position in life, they're extraordinary people. One of them, for example, the chairman of the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, where the advisor, Edgar Cheng, he was a cancer specialist at Sloan Kettering for 15 years before he became chairman. He's a medical doctor. Went to medical school in Ohio, Cornell. Went to undergraduate at Cornell. His family, one of the top families in Hong Kong. His wife was the fourth daughter of Y.K. Pao, who was the richest man in Hong Kong, and so forth. I mean, that type of marvelous people. But he knew nothing about stock exchanges, right? And I was his advisor, and we did a lot of, and I'd say, Edgar, you ought to do this, you ought to do that, and so forth. Cairo, the same way. The chairman of Cairo hired me, Sharif Rafat. Sharif Rafat's father was a national hero. He was a constitutional court judge that was the only judge that ruled that Nasser was legally elected, and therefore he was in prison for a year in exile. The family moved to Canada. I mean, that type of background. And Sharif is a genius. And Sharif, I met with Sharif 10 years ago in September, and he had wanted to do all these things. And I said, Sharif, there's not even an electric typewriter in this building, right? They're derelicts living in the basement, right? So we can do four things, right? You got to have a staff. You have to have a new trading system. The other thing, you don't have any authority. You got to get some authority. You got to get a law that gives you some authority and that type of thing, right? And like one of the things I'd recommended to many of them, that they create an options market and so forth. And ultimately, they all did it. Cairo is back to Cairo. The reason we were in Chicago 2 weeks ago with the chairman is they're now talking about the government is now pushing them which they are part of the government, owned by the government, the exchange there, to organize a futures and options market and a commodities exchange. But and they eventually will do it. But we're talking about that. I took the chairman to removed there to Chicago 3 years ago to talk about that. And then we were there 2 weeks ago to talk about it. You know?
Everything takes time.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, thanks for taking some time with me. I appreciate it.
Well, anything else, or?
I think we're probably good.
Good.
All right.
You've been terrific.
Well, thanks.
You want to have lunch?
Sure, that sounds great.